Okay, today I'm in Bath with ex-Rails bookmaker Stephen Little. Thanks very much for agreeing to do this today, Stephen. Can we go to the end, really, please, to begin with? You were the biggest and most famous Rails bookmaker in the country, and you decided to call it a day when the National Joint Pitch Council took over managing the rings. When was that and why was that?
Well, that was in 1999, I think, or was it 1998? They spent about a year sort of working out the new rules and so on. And during that time, I came to realise that the business was going to change radically. And I think what really worried me was that not only did the NJPC not know what they were doing, they didn't know that they didn't know what they were doing. And they were going to make so many new rules, which I thought didn't make sense. And I wrote any number of letters saying so and explaining why. I think my main objections were they were going to let too many bookies in, not only too many bookies, but too many bookies who didn't really know what they were going to do, and who were only there for fun. And I think in any business, it's very difficult to compete with people who don't need to make a profit at it. Another thing was they were going to introduce a rule about attendances. You had to attend 25% of meetings at all your pitches. And I worked it out that I couldn't, even without holidays, or cancellations, I couldn't do 25% at all the pitches I had. So, and I wanted to be a full-time bookie. I didn't want to have to give pitches up. And yeah, during the course of that year, while they were hammering out the rules, I decided, well, it's going to change too much. I'm just not going to enjoy it anymore.
And did you ever regret that decision?
No, I think the more as time went on, the more right I thought I was.
Can you take us back to your beginnings? I mean, was there a family history of bookmaking?
No, my father was in a very different sort of business. He was a vicar.
Okay, so but how did your interest in the racing and bookmaking come from? Where did it come from?
Well, my first taste of bookmaking was at prep school. There was a tradition that boys would make a book on the National each year. But my last year, this was at the age of 12, somebody else had bagged that. So I thought, well, I'll make a book on the Lincoln, because that was a much bigger race then as part of the big double, spring double. And so I did that with two partners. And we weren't allowed money at that school, so it had to be in sweets. But my two partners and I had a good feed afterwards. That was when Marshall Pill won.
So was that the catalyst when you decided, right, I want to be
not
a bookie?
Not really, no. At the next school, I got interested in racing and, eventually went racing for the first time in school holidays in 1960. And then a year or two later, I got more interested and gradually decided, I hadn't really had much thought about what to do as a career. I gradually decided whether I'd like to be a bookie.
So how did you take your first steps towards becoming a bookie?
I left school at 16 and you can't work in bookmaking till 18. So that was a very good excuse to have a year off, or about a year and a quarter off, which I spent just cycling around race courses. And then after that, I went to London and got a job with a firm called Beresford & Smith, which was part of Heathorns, in New Bond Street in London.
So it was off course?
Yes, that was in the office. And I was there for about 18 months. But although they had Rails pitches, I wanted to go on the racecourse with them, and I didn't look like doing so. So after 18 months, I left and started cycling around again.
So who was the first bookmaker you worked for on course?
Bloke called Noel Ray from Harrogate. He had a few Rails pitches. I lived at Lincoln at that time, so I used to, and he had pitches in mostly in Yorkshire, and up at Newcastle and such places. So I used to travel up and work for him odd days.
Was he a particularly big layer?
Not really, no, but it was a useful experience.
So those days, it must have been quite lively on the racecourse. Were there any particular bookmakers you looked up to at the time and thought I would have emulated them?
Well, John Joyce was one of the big bookies. Victor Chandler Senior. There were lots of big bookies then, which, you know, it's a dying, well, dead race, almost. I suppose they're the two names that spring to mind. Bernard Howard was another big one.
So when did you actually become a bookmaker in your own right, and when did you first stand up?
Well, I got my licence in 1971. But slightly before that, I started betting at Bristol Dogs with a man called Vic Gardner, who was an ex-jockey, and we had a half share in a pitch in the outside ring at Bristol Dogs, and after a few years he got fed up with that, so I took over. I think we started that in late 1970, and then 1971 I got my licence, and the first race I bet was at the Waterloo Cup in 1971.
Okay, the Waterloo Cup, that's been quite a big thing in your career, I remember.
Yes.
You can tell us a bit about that?
Well, I bet as every... I first went in 1968, and I went to every one since, you know, starting betting in 1971. And not only was it my first appearance as a bookmaker, it was my last appearance in my own name in 2005, which was the last Waterloo Cup before coursing was banned in this country.
Back in the days of racecourse bookmaking in the 70s, you would have had to put your name down for pitches, etc. How long did it take to get up the list before you started being allowed to bet?
Well, a long time, because I put my name down. Well, I started off with a few silvering pitches. I think my first pitch, tax pitch, was either Chepstow or Young, I can't remember which now. And then, well, I put my name down for just about everywhere in the South and Midlands. And as an example of how long waiting lists were, I put my name down for Toaster. And by the time I was giving up, I was still only number 6 on the waiting list there.
So?
But then I started betting, or rather, I got a job betting for someone on the rails, a firm called Thomas Henry Day, who had just a few pitches, and I was the rep, which meant I had to give up the few pitches I had, which, according to the rules, which I knew would happen. And that was a bit of a springboard, really, because after a few years, they gave up. And I thought, the only way to get pitches is going to be by applying on the rails, because it was easy to get pitches on the rails then. That was in the days before boards. So I thought, I'll apply for some rails pitches, and I know I'm jumping at the deep end, and I'll either learn to swim or I'll drown.
So how did that work with, I would imagine, limited finances?
Well, as you say, finances were limited, I think I made some crucial decisions, probably three crucial decisions at the time. One was to not have opinions, just to bet for figures. Another was not to force money. By going over the odds, because that is definitely the way to ruin. So, if the money came, it came, but I wouldn't, if it didn't, I'd just wait until it did. And the third was to, to take any bets that were offered, even if I had to hedge them at lower prices.
That's what I was going to ask you. I remember seeing the adverts in the trade paper when I was quite young, Bet with a Little Man. I think it's prior to Royal Ascot. And if I remember right, you laid some huge bets on some odds on shots after that. So did you, you took on all comers regardless of how shrewd they were supposed to be?
Yes, yes. My view was that, I'm trying to make a book, and the more people you've got betting with you, I wouldn't say easier, but the less hard that is to do. Because if they all want to back, even if the shrewd is, if they all want to back the horse, same horse, only the first one in gets on. But sometimes they'll want to back different horses, and that makes your book.
So did you have a different strategy as time went on for different punters that you sort of thought, he can't win, he'll never win, he's lively?
No. If they wanted to back, if they wanted to take the price I was offering, they could be on.
So did you hedge most of what you took?
Well, I hedged quite a lot, yes. You had to try and balance the book out. Not that it was always very balanced, but that was the aim.
So was there a figure in your head how much you would risk one for, or would you try and tidy the book up nicely if it was possible?
No, I didn't have a particular figure. How much I'd stand them for, depended on the market, really, which you had to have a feel for. And sometimes, of course, I got lumbered and had stood one for too much, and sometimes they won and sometimes they didn't.
One of my old bosses was Ivor Perry, I believe you know. Well, obviously, you know him, he worked for you. He said that he was sent to back one back, and you still lost 99,000 on the race. How did you used to cope mentally with losses like that?
You just had to. You just had to grit your teeth and pray. So, you just had to swallow and hope for better luck next time.
So what would have been your biggest ever single losing day?
Probably when Frankie Dettori won the 7 races at Ascot.
What sort of figures were we talking about there?
I can't remember the figure, but it was a lot, put it like that.
Okay. And what about winning day?
I think the best winning day was probably a Gold Cup day at Cheltenham. But it was only to break level on the meeting, because that was when it was 3 days. The first day was a record losing day, not only a record losing day, it was more than twice the previous record. The second day was also a bad day, worse than the previous record. And the third day, I just about got it all back. I was virtually allowed to write my own results.
Well, so you mentioned before you take bets off of anybody, but were there any punters in the end that you'd refuse bets point blank from?
Not if I thought their credit was good, no. I certainly refused people if I didn't think they were going to pay, but not because I thought they were going to win.
Now that brings me on to my next question. I imagine that those colossal sums you took, especially talking 20 years ago, were credit bets. How big a problem were knockers in those days?
It was an occupational hazard. If I'd made the decision never to give anyone any credit, I don't think I'd have got anywhere. But certainly, it was a problem. It remains a problem. It's just something you got to put up with. I do wish, though, that at the time I could have sued people for the bets. Whereas you can now, you couldn't then.
No, I was going to ask that, but it must have been frustrating at the time. Do people still owe now? Can you chase them?
Oh, yes, yeah. It's quite a while since I actually drawn anything there.
So what was the biggest ever single bet you took, can you remember?
There are 3 possible answers to that. It depends whether you mean the largest stake or the largest liability or the the largest bet, which is the true measure of a bet, is the takeout, you know, the stake plus the potential winnings. The largest stake was 150,000 on an odds on in the Gold Cup, in fact, on an odds on shot. The largest liability was 250,000 to 30, I think, at Cheltenham. The largest takeout, I can't actually remember, but probably might have been 100,000 at, I don't know, 94, 52, something like that.
And back in those days, did people really used to come up with plastic bags full?
Not to that extent, but yeah, sometimes they might be tens of thousands, it wouldn't be hundreds of thousands, but yeah, people used to have tens of thousands sometimes in cash.
Did you ever suffer losing runs that made you take a long look into the deep hod and wonder how much more can I lose before I have to turn it in?
Sometimes. I can remember one calendar year that I was still behind, I think, in October. I don't mean I'd lost every day, but that year. But I think I was still behind on the year in October and managed to just squeak out in front, I think. But yes, but yeah, if you can't put up with losing runs, it shouldn't be a bookie.
So how did you cope with those times, and could you switch off when you cut on from the races?
Yes, I think so, to some extent, yes.
Stephen, can you tell us, please, about your early experiences working for bookmakers on the racecourse? Did you sort of do an apprenticeship as such?
Not a formal apprenticeship, but after working for Noel Ray, I was used to travel around, and well, then I moved back to London and used to go racing, and used to go to the races and just see if I could get a job for the day, and that was a great apprenticeship because working for lots of different bookies, I'd see how different bookies would operate, and during that time I formed the opinion that those who had opinions about horses didn't seem to do as well as the ones that didn't have opinions. And I think that was what pushed me along that path of, betting to figures and not looking for winners. Other bookies I worked for, I worked for Ladbrokes for a year. Worked for a bookie from Hitchin called Bert Smoothie. One of his favourite sayings was, never bet on anything that talks. Eddie Baxter from the West Country, in Glastonbury, I used to work for. And as I say, lots of different bookies. All over the country.
I remember Eddie Baxter, from my days, he always was the first to price up. Was that the case when you worked with him?
Yes, it was, yeah.
So did he do his own tissue?
Yes, yeah.
Talking of Eddie Baxter, who getting on with Avalon, who I remember very well, he had a favourite saying, apparently.
Yes, he always used to say that, it's a common saying that you never see a poor bookie, but of course he pointed out that the reason for that is that when they become poor, they're not bookies anymore.
You did mention to me when we weren't filming that you made a living betting on photographs at one point.
Yes, that was in the 60s. I realised that there was money to be made. Because in those days it took a lot longer to announce the result. And, you could get to reasonable bets on sometimes. Didn't make fortunes at it, but it was enough to keep me going. And apart from that, it was very good at sharpening me up because in those days, you didn't know how long you had. You tried to get as many bets as possible. You never knew where the price was going to pop up in the ring. And the way they announce it nowadays, they say something like, here is the result of the third race. In those days, it was just winner number one, absolute sudden death. So you really had to, be on your toes.
So did you have to nudge Alex Bird off his pitch? Was he still operating in those days?
No, I think that was probably a bit after his time.
So what gave you the edge? What made you sure that you were more eagle-eyed than the judge?
Well, experience. Well, it wasn't a question of being more eagle-eyed than the judge, because the judge had the benefit of the photo finish. It was just a question of, standing on the line, really concentrating on what was coming up, not watching the horses as they approached the line, but fixing your gaze on the line, and then running out as fast as possible and trying to guess where the price would, a decent price would pop up with the bookies.
Now, I always think that your local course, Bath, got a pretty deceptive angle. Were there any courses that you used to really like best on the photographs?
Well, Ascot was a good one, because I remember once I managed to get an even £25 on with Victor Chandler when the result had been announced, because it was so, the angle was so deceptive, they just didn't believe the announcement. They thought the announcer had made a mistake.
You ever feel a little hint of guilt after that, Stephen?
Not at all, no. Another, and this is another record which takes unlikely to be beaten. I once got on a photo when the winning distance was 10 lengths.
How on earth did you manage that?
Well, that was at Newton Abbott, and as they were approaching the line, the jockey on the second was falling off, and nobody knew whether he'd fallen off before the line or after the line. But I thought that the one with the jockey on had won anyway, so I was quite confident to back that, and it transpired the jockey had fallen off before the line, and it was 10 lengths back to the one that should have been third.
Now, I understand you've also got another unenviable record that you don't think you'd be beaten. You knocked out an eye-watering amount of money on, I believe, the Wokingham, and you didn't even lay the winner. What happened there?
Yes, I lost 23,000 on the Wokingham, and just on laying each way bet. And the clerk, I said to the clerk, well, John Durston, how did we go on that race? And he said, oh, you lost 23,000. And I thought, oh, good job I didn't lay the winner then. That would have been a lot worse. I think that's probably the most a bookie's ever lost on a race without laying the winner.
So were the percentages for each way handicaps as bad in those days, or was it just pure bad luck that?
Well, it was, I suppose, bad luck that the shrewd punters, chose to bet with me.
And there's another thing you were telling me, that there's something that annoys you in modern times, that the chap on the stool is not necessarily the person that makes the decisions or provides the money. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, the NAB used to have a very good rule that the man whose money it was had to be on the stool taking the bet. And that way, if a punter goes into a bet, he gets an instant decision on whether he's on or not, which is not the case nowadays.
So is it particularly frustrating when you think you're on and then you're not because there's a steward's inquiry behind the joint?
Yes, it is. It can be frustrating. And again, quite often you ask for the bet when the price is on the light board, and all of a sudden it's disappeared, and they say, oh, sorry, no, the price has gone, when really it hadn't gone when I asked for the price.
And something else I remember, this is just something that's cropped up in my mind, you must have been one of the first bookmakers to utilise a mobile phone for accepting bets on course, and if I remember betting next to you at Taunton, you were sort of taking bets on the away meetings as well as the home meeting. Was that something that really took off?
Yes, I was only taking them from bookmakers because, the law at the time was you could take hedging money from off-course bookies and it was still tax-free. And that could liven up the quietest day. You could be absolutely dead on the course and then the day would come to life if a bookie rang up for a reasonable bet.
So would they be the sort of bets that they wanted to actually hedge money, or would they be to shorten up, or a bit of each?
Well, a bit of both.
Now, talking of memorable days, Stephen, can you give us one or two?
Well, one was probably Arkell's first Gold Cup, because that was at the time when Arkell and Millhouse were both rivals for the top of the tree, and the build-up to that Gold Cup was tremendous rivalry. Far more than the rivalry between Denman and Corto Star. And it was a great time to be getting interested in racing, really, to see the rivalry between the two. And that was his first Gold Cup. And then his third Gold Cup, I was working in London at the time for Beresford & Smith. Somehow I managed to get the day off for Gold Cup. And I thought I'd like to go to Cheltenham. So the evening before, I cycled to Oxford and stayed in the youth hostel there. The next day, I cycled from Oxford to Cheltenham before racing, and after racing, cycled back to near Hatfield, where I was living at the time. And that was the longest distance I did in a day, about 150 miles. But I certainly knew I'd been for a bike ride by the time I got home.
Did you avail yourself of any of the 1 to 10 to pay the X's?
No, I was never a big odds on punter like that, except on photos.
How did Cheltenham in those days compare to these days?
Well, it wasn't nearly as big. I mean, it was still one of the biggest meetings of the year, but it wasn't quite the big deal that it is now.
I believe you had a bit of notoriety as, dare we say, a mean bookmaker at one point?
Yes, Gus Dalrymple, who used to amusement column in the Life. He said he was fed up with hearing, who's the greatest bookie, who's the biggest and who's the greatest. So he thought, well, I'd like to know who's the meanest bookie. So I thought, that's me. So I wrote in, and of course I didn't put a stamp on the letter. You can't write in and say you're the meanest bookie and put a stamp on the letter, can you? So I started off saying, thank you, Gus, for paying the postage due. And I think I'm the meanest bookie. And so he came out, and he came to Lark Hill with me one day, but he decided I wasn't quite mean enough to win the title of the meanest bookie.
You didn't give him honours at the end of the day, did you?
No, I didn't. Whatever honours are.
Hey, Steve, a bit like your career from silver ring to the rails, you've just explained that you were labelled the meanest bookie, but you're also known as the bookie to the stars. So how did that transformation come about?
Well, very gradually. I remember when I first started betting in the silver ring, we used to clerk in shillings, because that was a pound was quite a big bet, but that was going as 20, not one. But later on, Paul Haig once described, he used to write in the, I'm not sure if he was in the Racing Post or the Sporting Life, but he described me as bookmaker to the stars, which was probably a fair comment at the time.
So which stars used to bet with you?
The big punters like Michael Tabor and J.P. McManus. And, lot of people, a lot of trainers and owners, which made life interesting.
Those sort of names have put a shiver down the spine of most bookies, surely.
Yes, yeah.
Now tell us a bit more about the Waterloo Cup, because that, of course, a sport that's been outlawed, and obviously a passion of yours, you did it for quite a long time. Any particular memories of the Waterloo Cup, any exchanges or events?
Of course, coursing wasn't only the Waterloo Cup, just as racing isn't only the Derby or the Grand National. There were meetings throughout the winter, and the Waterloo Cup, of course, was the big one where all the good dogs would run. I very much enjoyed going coursing, and it was the one sport where I did have an opinion, because I had to. There was a lot of meetings. I was the only bookie, so I had to do quite a bit of homework on the coursing, and it was there was a form book, proper form book for it, which occasionally I contributed to. If the regular correspondent wasn't there, I'd do a write-up on the meeting. And even for the Waterloo Cup, I had to do quite a lot of homework to get the prices out. I had a half share in a dog which won the, not the cup unfortunately, but won the purse, which is the consolation stake for the first round losers. So that was the highlight of my dog owning career. But it was, coursing as a whole, I miss that far more than being a bookie on the rails.
So how many meetings a year would there be coursing then that you would attend?
Well, in the winter I might go to, two or three a week. And it'd be all over the country, including up to Scotland. And I remember there used to be quite a few Irish priests come coursing, especially in my early days. And one of them said that when I was carrying the joint from field to field, because unlike a racecourse, it would be in a farm on, with absolutely no facilities. We'd be in one field for an hour or so, and then another field for the next hour. And I'd carry my joint from field to field, and this priest said I reminded him of Jesus Christ carrying his cross.
You know what happened to him.
So, well, indeed, it was a heavy burden that I had to bear.
So it must have taken some pricing up, especially the Waterloo Cup. About 150 runners, were there?
No, there were 64 runners.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And it was on a knockout basis over 3 days. So it'd be, the winning dog had to win six courses to win. And at one time, before my time, it was a huge betting event. And William Hill used to bet there just after the war, and as did quite a few other bookies. Joe Coyle also, he made his name. He was the first off-course bookie to offer odds. I think this was in the 1920s. He was the first bookie to offer odds in London on the various courses. And when I first went there, and this shows the march of technology, they used to get the results out every three courses. Someone would cycle off to a nearby house to where there was a phone to relay the results by phone to Extel. And I can remember when I was at Beresford, we used to have a ticker tape machine, and the results would come over on that. And then a few years after my first going, I remember a bookie turning up with a satellite dish, and he was betting on the Hong Kong racing. And that was the march of technology.
Of course, the sporting life correspondent for coursing was no less than John McCrook. Did he used to turn up?
Yes, I used to. He couldn't drive, so he used to travel with me all over the place. So we've shared many a journey up and down the country to coursing meetings.
You wouldn't take the Bentley to one of them, surely?
Yes. It performed remarkably well on soggy fields sometimes, whereas other cars would be really struggling to make any progress on in the mud. Yeah, the Bentley would sail through it.
Stephen, I've had to turn the camera on again because you just told me a wonderful John McCrook story. Can you repeat that one, please?
Yes, we were up at Altcar, up in Lancashire, for not for the Waterloo Cup, but for one of the minor meetings up there. And he thought it'd be a good idea to go around and see Red Rum, so which was stabled at Southport at that time. So we went into this huge stable, but he was a huge horse. And I'm a bit nervous getting around near horses. I don't like to get within kicking and biting distance of them. And all John could think of saying was that he was hoping that Red Rum would lash out and kill me, because it would make such a great story. Red Rum kills Wales bookmaker.
It's So being the man of mystery, Stephen, as Jack Lynn used to describe you, there seemed to be quite a few rumours flying around about you, one of which I think you were moving to Australia at some point.
Well, yes, I went to Australia to the Melbourne Cup and a few other meetings shortly before I gave up. And I'd already made the decision to give up. And when I got back, I heard a rumour that I'd gone there with a view to moving out there and starting up again there. In fact, nothing had been further from my mind. And even if it had been, when I got there, I'd have changed my mind. I remember the first meeting I went to there was at Randwick, which is the biggest course in Sydney. And I got there a bit late. Have a look at the ring, which was behind the stand. Ran up to the stand to watch the first race, and I thought there'd been a bomb scare. There was almost no one there. So I certainly didn't think that was the place to start again.
Did you get involved then in the bookmakers over there, the Waterhouses or anybody?
No. I mean, I spoke to a few and asked them what the scene was like, which was interesting, but I certainly didn't have any thought about moving out there. And another rumour in my early days, what it was that I wasn't there making a book. This was particularly at Eastfield Dogs in Bristol. I wasn't there as a career. I was only there because I was going to write a thesis on the bookmaking. But again, that was a long way from the truth.
What would the business have been like at those dog tracks back in those days?
Well, I was only in the second ring, but it was viable, certainly. What was rather extraordinary was that there would be periods of time when, whatever they backed, if they backed two dogs in a race, they'd be first and second all the way around. And that would go on for ages. And yet there'd be other times where what they backed beforehand, bore no relation at all to what happened in the race. Unfortunately, the first period was more common than the second period.
Did you get the impression that it was not necessarily straight horse racing?
Yes, I'd say so, yeah.
And many sort of lumpy bets there, did you have to try and avoid them?
Yes, well, again, you'd only bet to how you felt the market was. And at that time I was concerned to be a reasonable sized layer, but I wasn't trying to take the whole track on, especially from the second ring.
Ben Keefe started at the Dogs quite young, now runs Star Sports. He mentioned that quite a few punters would be quite intimidating when they were trying to get on. Were you ever cowtailed by people like that?
Not particularly, no.
Stephen, you mentioned you'd share a dog. Have you ever got involved with horse racing as an owner?
Yes, I had a half share in a horse once. I was trained by Toby Balding. And she won the Jersey Vase, which is not to be confused with the Jersey Stakes, because it was actually in Jersey. But we couldn't even get placed on the mainland, unfortunately. And that was an interesting experience, but I haven't been tempted to dabble again, because I feel if you own a horse, it's a bit like taking evens about a 10-1 shot. And I wouldn't mind taking 7 or 8 to 1, just for the interest, but I think the odds are stacked so much against you that it's rather less than tempting.
Did you have a bet on the win at the Jersey Vase?
No, because the figures out there were definitely not conducive to tempting you to have a bet.
Once a bookmaker, always a bookmaker.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I was quite involved with the NAB, National Association of Bookmakers, for quite a while, and I was president of the local association, West of England Bookmakers Association, which meant going to London for NAB meetings quite often, and pitch committee meetings and appeals and so on, which again was interesting. I was quite involved with the negotiations that led to the upheaval on in racecourse bookmaking. Unfortunately, they didn't turn out to be very good for the future of bookmaking, I felt. It was very frustrating, though, to be... I always felt, you know, listening to RCA personnel, boards on the rails was inevitable. And I spent a lot of time thinking about ways not to avoid it, because I knew that couldn't happen, but to make it come in fairly for all bookmakers, not just rails bookmakers, but for tax bookmakers as well. And it was very irritating to be thought of only being there to look after my own interests, and at the end, in fact, to be virtually hounded out of the presidency of the West of England Association, and not to be recognised as trying to do my best for all bookmakers, not just for myself, which it may be fair to say a lot of people involved in bookmaking politics were mainly looking out for their own interests rather than bookmakers as a whole.
So you left before boards actively came onto the rails.
Yes.
Do you think that would have had a positive or a detrimental effect on your business had you still been standing?
I suppose it would have helped. It depends. I mean, one proposal I made was that bookmakers... I did recognise that if boards on the rails suddenly came, it wouldn't be fair for me to stay on the rails in front of bookmakers who had far more seniority in the ring. The one proposal I made was that bookmakers who wanted to stay on the rails without a board should be allowed to do so, you know, irrespective of their seniority. Whereas the boards, the pitches on the rails with boards would be allocated, you know, with regard to seniority. And yeah, I felt I could compete, you know, without a board, because in fact at somewhere like Stratford, the setup was that I was virtually next to bookies with boards. And obviously it was to some extent a disadvantage to be without a board. But I felt it was one I could cope with.
Of course, the main advantage for anyone that was on the rails when it came in would have been their pitch value would have rocketed, surely.
Yes. Yes, I suppose if there's one regret, it's not. It's that I didn't hang on until boards came in, and I'd have got more for my pitches. But on the other hand, the game was so bad at the time, I might have lost that. Yeah. In the meantime, betting on the rails, you know, for that year or two.
You say the game was gone, but have you seen that recently a pitch went for over 100,000 for Ascot? Or was it Cheltenham? I forget which one it was now, but they're still fetching astronomical amounts of money.
Well, they are, and I suppose, yeah, the festival meetings, there is money to be made, but I'm still glad I'm not there. I think it's... I just don't think I'd be enjoying it. I mean, you know, all the irritations, the paperwork. I mean, for instance, my licence, it used to cost £20 to renew for 3 years, and it was one side of A4. And now a licence is hundreds of pounds every year, and it's about 35 pages because of all the paperwork. And, you know, you could put up with that if you're making bundles of money, but... not convinced that that there are, you know, throughout the year, bundles of money to be made. And at ordinary meetings nowadays, it's pitiful to see how few bookies there are there compared to what there used to be.
I mean, when the boards came in on the rails, a lot of the mystique of a rails bookmaker must have vanished, and you'd think they probably became glorified Tattersall's bookmakers at that point.
Yes, it's certainly changed the business radically. Nowadays, you've got silvering bookies on the rails, and and which I think is a mistake, because you know, you see them offering a price and you can't get a decent bet on with them. One other thing I wouldn't like to be doing in present day circumstances is those huge joints that everyone has to carry around. I remember when I lived in Devizes, I'd lost my driving licence and I had to get to Yarmouth to bet there. And I cycled the 10 miles to Pusey with a joint on the back of the bike to get on the train to Yarmouth. And I certainly wouldn't like to attempt that with the present day joints.
Where did all the readies go?
They were in my pocket. They didn't take much space, unfortunately.
So you used to take big bets as well, small bets as well as big bets, I understand.
Yes, I think it was important to, I felt I was there to offer a service, not just for my own benefit. And so I used to take small bets as well, and always used to say that as far as women were concerned, the minimum bet was inversely proportional to their chest size.
Stephen, you mentioned Thomas Henry Day earlier. Now, I borrowed a book off of another bookmaker years ago, a fantastic read about the days back in the 30s. I believe there's something in there that you quite like the quote of.
Yes, one of his favourite quotes was from Julius Caesar, Shakespeare. There is a tide in the affairs of men which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Or in modern day terms, when you're in form, crack on. Because what he forgets to mention is that later in the play, Brutus, whose quote that is, commits suicide.
So one thing that you were known for, you were a very flamboyant character on course. You used to arrive in your Bentley with your staff, wearing your mink coat. Staff were always paid way above everybody else, and you lived in a very des res. I mean, how important to your business was your image?
Well, it is important. It was a musquash coat, actually. The purpose of that was not so much for the image, but to keep warm, because if you stood all day out in the freezing cold, I did feel the cold. So that was an effective way of not feeling too cold. But the image, it is important. I think the main image I wanted, though, was of integrity, which I like to think I have maintained.
So in the 80s and 90s, you were renowned for taking huge bets, even at small tracks. Do you think that facilitating getting lumps on at those places encouraged plots just to sort of tuck you up?
Well, it may have done, but I think the fact that I survived through them shows that they weren't all that successful on the whole, or that prevalent.
In those situations, for someone like Exeter, for example, if somebody came up and asked for a bet over and above what you would normally expect at that track, would you smell a rat and sort of have or quarter them?
It depends on how I felt the strength of the market was, but no, I think it was important to retain the reputation for taking whatever was thrown at me.
Were there any contemporaries in those days that were your sort of competitors, if you like, on the rails that would be taking similar size bets to you at the time? Single men like yourself, not firms?
Victor Chandler, probably. He'd probably be the main independent rival. Certainly not Ladbrokes and Hills. You had to be a registered mug to get on with them. And there used to be saying that if you could get on with Ladbrokes, you didn't want to be on.
Now, there's a story about a charity race where I think some punters and maybe even combatants in it turned out to be less than charitable. Can you remember much? Can you tell us a bit about that one?
Yes, that was Gibberine at Chepstow. I presume that's the race you're thinking of. Where Declan Murphy rode the winner, and he'd come back from quite a nasty accident, and the jockeys let him win. Or most of the jockeys, I wouldn't say they were all non-dry, but most of the jockeys just let him win. And somehow it had been engineered that he'd got the ride on the favourite, although it was supposed to be a random ballot. And, the word had got out somehow that it was crooked. And I was very disappointed that the authorities didn't clamp down on what had happened.
Am I correct in thinking that was quite near the end of your career before you turned it in?
No, I think that was 1995. So it was about 5 years before I gave up.
Okay, so when you did finally leave, stuck to your guns and the NJPC took over, you worked briefly for Corals. Was it hard to go from being an independent, self-made man to working for a wage?
Yes, I suppose it was. But what was particularly frustrating was all the office interference. And originally, Coles were quoted probably in the papers as saying, well, we're going to let him, Stephen, bet as he used to bet. And when it came to it, there was too much office interference. They'd say, tell me which horses not to lay and so on. And if I laid a thick bet, sometimes they'd tell the floor men, without me knowing even, to have it back. And when we won, it was because the office guys were geniuses. And when they lost, when we lost, it was because I was an idiot. So yes, it was quite frustrating.
Back in those days, I remember your clerk, I believe he was called John, was revered around the ring because people would hear you machine gunning bets into him, ranging from grands to pound each ways. I don't think I ever saw him on the race course again after you finished. Do you know what happened to him?
Yes, he was a good clerk, certainly. He had just about all the qualities you want in a clerk, really. He was neat, discreet, fast, accurate. But after I gave up, he worked with us at Coles for a while on the course. Then eventually he drove a taxi. He lived in Street, so he drove a taxi around Somerset. And then he died a few years ago from lung cancer.
Okay, sorry to hear that. Mm. In the 20 years since you've left the betting ring, there have been some huge changes, not least the betting exchanges. Have you sat back thinking you got out at the right time?
Yes, very much so. I used to think, what a shame I wasn't born a few years early, and, because I've missed the best years. And now I think, well, thank goodness all the changes happened at the end of my career and not in the middle of it.
Okay, so how do you feel about modern-day bookmakers and the betting ring as it is now? Do you recognise it at all from your halcyon days?
Not really, no. It's very different now.
Do you think it's even worth, sort of, would you even think about being a bookmaker now if you were 20?
Probably if I was 20, I wouldn't know what I'd missed. So it certainly wouldn't be as attractive as a proposition as it was then.
Okay, you're still a regular face on quite a few race courses. Are you a gamekeeper turned poacher now?
Yes, I suppose so, to some extent. One aspect of modern-day bookmakers, which I really can't understand, is their objection to arbitrage. There are some bookies who absolutely refuse to take my bets, because they think, usually quite rightly, that I'm just trading. But I really can't see the objection to that. If they're offering a price, what does it matter, what the punter wants to do with his bet once he's had it? I used to take loads of bets from Tic Tacs, and it never bothered, knowing, of course, that someone in another ring was trading on that, and it never bothered me at all that someone might be earning out of that. Yeah, if I was offering the price, I was quite happy to lay it.
Do you think it's an irrational obsession they've got these days?
I do, yes. And, for some of them who, want to be seen as big bookies, It's just totally illogical that they don't want to take any sort of bet from me.
Going back to when you were making a book, even as an on-course bookmaker, you were pretty much a household name. What qualities do you think were needed then to be a very successful bookmaker as to now?
Determination, I suppose, to succeed. Unflappability. Not to get tied up having opinions on horses. Integrity, as I referred to before. That's probably the main things.
Was it difficult not to have an opinion when, for example, one of your shrewdest punters that you found it hard to beat came up and had a really big bet on one?
Not really, no. Because I knew some of them would win and some wouldn't.
So you played very big. What type of racing and what time of year did you find it best to be a big layer?
I didn't really distinguish between times of year and that's what I suppose it was a bit harder in the summer when going was consistent. Because if the weather was consistent, sometimes you get a sudden downpour. I always like to see jockeys coming the unusual side of a race course, because that always was always a good recipe for turn-ups.
Okay, so you talked earlier about greyhound racing. You started the greyhound racing, then you went on with the Waterloo Cup coursing. Is that still a love of yours? Do you still follow greyhound racing?
I've never been that keen on greyhound racing. I've always preferred coursing, because that's the real thing.
Okay, thank you. And the other thing you mentioned earlier was cycling around race courses. I understand you cycled to all of them, including quite a few that don't even exist anymore. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, after I left school, and even during the school holidays, that cycling was the only form of transport I could afford. So I used to cycle around and stay at youth hostels, which were 3 and 6 a night. And most weeks, I might be away from home. Was based in Lincoln at that time. Might be home away from home for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. So when I went up to Scotland, obviously I'd do all the Scottish ones at the same time. And I used to be able to do that it cost me about £3 a week, going racing 5 and 6 days a week, which seems incredible now. But, I had to watch every penny at that time. Sometimes if I say £3 a week, that's if there was nothing unexpected. But sometimes I might have to buy an inner tube, which was 6 and 8 pence, and a tyre, which was 13 and 4 pence, at the same time. That was a whole pound, and that was a real blow to the budget, that was, if that happened.
Were you any good at punting in those days?
Not particularly. I mean, I'd have bets, but though in those days I didn't keep a record of how I was betting, so I'm probably lost, but probably only lost fairly slowly.
And you mentioned at the beginning of the interview that your father was a vicar. What was his opinion of your chosen career path?
Well, he certainly wasn't what he'd planned, but he did have the good sense to let me do what I wanted to do, for which I'm grateful. Well, I did get as far as going to an interview at Queen's College, Cambridge, but I didn't really want to go, but I thought I'd go, because my parents wanted me to go. And the morning the date they gave me happened to be the morning of a Newmarket race meeting. So I thought I could go to the interview and cycle off to the races. But I was quite frank about not really wanting to go, so they didn't actually offer me a place. But that was the nearest I got to going to university. But instead, I'm a proud graduate of the University of Life.
So So what would have been the subject had you had the misfortunes have been accepted?
Maths.
Oh, well, that's not a bad grounding for a bookie.
No.
So looking back on your career, what would you not do again, if anything?
I don't know the answer to that, really. There's nothing, no particular major things. Obviously, there were bets I wish I hadn't laid, particular bets. There were particular people I wish I hadn't given credit to. But I don't think there are any major things that I do differently.
So finally, from all your experience on the race course, what that's happened to you or with your business has taught you a lesson that you'd advise young bookmakers to learn from?
That again, I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I think I'd still advise people not to have opinions on horses. I don't think there's much I can add to that, really. Well, I started off my career with really two ambitions in mind. One, to be a bookmaker and just survive. I didn't particularly aim to be a top bookmaker. And secondly, to raise the image of bookmakers, which at the time was pretty low, because quite often you'd see some minor case came up in a magistrate court and the man would claim to be a bookmaker or bookie's runner. And this was in the days before you really needed a proper license to be a bookie, so it was just a convenient thing to be described as. I'm not sure. I think the image of bookmakers has risen in the time, although I don't claim any particular credit for that. But and people used to ask me if I was going to be the second William Hill, and I always answered, no, I'm going to be the first Stephen Little. And I suppose I succeeded in that.
So would you do it all again?
Not in the present circumstances, no, because it's so different now. I don't think, if I tried to bet now as I used to, I'd be slaughtered in no time, I think.
Okay, Stephen, thank you very much.
Right.
Star Sports TV, our weekly magazine TV programme packed with tips, news and banter on the key sports events of the week. Check out the latest episode at starsportsbet.co.uk. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.